Welcome all to the panel discussing the 25th anniversary of the Supreme Court's decision in Chevron. And I don't know really what to think of all you here. Oh, I'm sorry, I forgot to give you the nod. I was supposed to nod at the gentleman and say, I'm starting now. We're starting now. It seems as though most people have settled in, and I really don't know what to think about the fact that you all are here, given the fact that there are two other very interesting panels going on at the same time. I understand, though, that materials from those panels, including probably a podcast, I don't know whether it's going to be audio, video, or both. I hope that if it's video, it's also audio. But I'm too going to listen to some of the other things that are going on right now. You know, 25 years ago, in the October term 1983, the Supreme Court issued its opinion in Chevron versus Natural Resources Defense Council. Few judicial opinions of administrative law have generated so much scholarly debate. Some maintain that no other opinion has had as much impact as Chevron on administrative law and the regulatory state. Others contend that Chevron merely changed the terminology of judicial review without appreciably changing its substance. The panel today will address, one, whether Chevron has changed the scope of judicial review at all, and if so, whether it has been, as Martha Stewart might say, a good thing. And, two, whether recent modifications have diminished Chevron or merely recognized that it didn't really replace the legal doctrines that held sway before it. In other words, this panel reflects on 25 years of Chevron, its impact, its evolution, its past, and its future. Each member of our panel today is a recognized expert in administrative law generally and on Chevron in particular. And I'm pleased to be with you today to moderate this panel's discussion of 20 years of administrative law after Chevron. You know, you might have noticed that there has been a presidential campaign that recently came to a conclusion many people in this particular group are not necessarily pleased and delighted about the outcome. But during the campaign itself, I know that I often gritted my teeth and had a little steam coming out of my ears when I kept hearing one of the candidates being referred to as the person who was the best person to run the country. I always wanted to leap up and yell at the television screen or the radio, they don't run the country. They run the government, not even all of the government. They run the executive branch of the government, to the extent it's possible to do so. And it is how the judicial branch is to review what the executive branch has done with what the legislative branch did that is the subject of our subject, Chevron, today. I have had some personal experience with the matter as Rich Morrison, my former deputy for appellate matters and acting assistant attorney general at the tax division himself, and now tax court judge, and I'd like to welcome some of my colleagues from the tax division, in addition to Rich Morrison, Mark Holmes, tax court judge, and David Gustafson, tax court judge, and other distinguished members of our audience today like Judge A. Raymond Randolph, who in 1992 gave this speech on Chevron and the plain meaning rule. And after we have had our panel discussion today, I will tell you whether anything's really changed in the last 16 years or whether I could have just read that to you today. But in any event, as head of the tax division for 6 years, I can tell you that administrative agencies do not always want their barristers in trial courts to be advocating for Chevron deference to their pronouncements. They would just as soon have the flexibility to completely abandon them. You know that a hallmark of Federalist Society events is that both sides of an issue are presented by people who are qualified to do so. And we've worked hard on this panel to gin up the kind of passionate contention that you might expect in a Federalist Society discussion of school vouchers, race or ethnicity as a factor in admissions of institutions of higher learning, the wisdom or constitutionality of our government using taxpayer dollars to acquire ownership of the industries our labor, environmental, and tax laws have driven into bankruptcy, or of habeas corpus rights for foreign enemies detained by our military troops. In the case of the legacy of the Chevron decision, however, I regret to report, no, I don't. I don't regret it, but I am here to report that the differing views of the consequences of the Chevron decision apparently do not inflame passion of the debate, if indeed there is more than one side to the debate at all. We have a very, we do bring different perspectives, and you are about to hear the different perspectives from the members of our panel, but they reach similar conclusions, which we can carve up and toss around later. So I'm very pleased to present to you our panelists today are the Honorable Ron Cass, who is president of Cass and Associates and dean emeritus of Boston College. I almost said that and then I corrected myself. I should have said, I'm sorry, Boston University School of Law. Kristen Hickman, who is a professor at the University of Minnesota. Professor Tom Merrill, who is a professor now, and I've just lost my place, and I know all these by heart anyway, but at where you've moved, now at Yale. And Professor Eckridge, who is at? No. No. Okay. Anyway, and our we've decided, because we couldn't have on this side of the debate and on that side of the debate, we're going in alphabetical order today, and we're starting with Dean Cass.
Thank you very much, Lee. Of course, as Lee said, we did have quite a debate about what to do with the panel. Should we call it Chevron? Is there any difference now from what it was before? How oily should we get up to discuss this? There were a number of different issues, but I think that we concluded at the end that while there were disagreements among us, they were the sort we'd have to work at inflaming people's passions on. I'm going to start with one just brief anecdote to sort of set the stage for the sort of interpretive problem we're going to be dealing with here. There was a fellow I knew who was very religious, very devout, and was very concerned about the question whether it was permissible to have sex on the Sabbath. And he had, looked at the text very carefully, tried to parse it about the, the laboring and the resting, and couldn't really come to a conclusion from the text, so he consulted a higher authority. He went to a priest and asked the priest whether he could have sex on the Sabbath. The priest said, well, it depends on whether it's work or play. Said, sex, of course, involves a lot of physical exertion, and therefore it's work and not permissible on the Sabbath. My friend thought about that and said, well, I mean, he's a priest. What does he know about sex? So he then consulted a minister who said, well, it does turn on whether it's work or play, and it does involve physical exertion, and in fact, the priest was correct. You cannot have sex on the Sabbath. He thought about that for a while and said, well, just to make sure I've got the bases covered, I'm going to ask a rabbi. So he asked a rabbi. The rabbi said, absolutely, you can. It's play. There's no doubt about it. And my friend just said, can you tell me how you can be so certain that it's play and not work? And the rabbi said, absolutely I can. If it were work, my wife would have the maid do it. Being Jewish, I tried that joke out on my wife, and she said, I don't understand. So, but she informed me at the end that it would require more jewelry if I told it in public. The Chevron case is about deference. It's about statutory interpretation. It's about who gets to say what things mean under what circumstances. And it's a case that has generated an enormous literature and an enormous amount of confusion. If you go back to the background before Chevron, it was understood that agencies all operate within a legal framework. And because we want our government officials and our government agencies operating under the law, we have a variety of ways of trying to make sure they do that. We have a set of background rules about how the institutions are organized, how the officials are appointed. We have the blunt instrument of elections to check when we think that agencies are getting a bit out of control. And we have a couple of legal canons that are supposed to make sure that agencies operate under the law. A canon that many of you who are over the age of 40 may have heard of is the non-delegation doctrine, a former doctrine that said that Congress could not hand out blank checks to agencies back in the days when they also weren't handing out blank checks to the Treasury Department, the automobile industry, the banking industry, and others. And the non-delegation doctrine was a way of saying you give specific enough instructions to agencies that you are telling them what to do, not simply saying, go out and do whatever you think is right for the world, which is ultimately a form of lawlessness. The non-delegation doctrine proved to be one that was not very easily enforced by judges who lacked the enthusiasm for saying to agencies and Congresses over and over, go back and redo it. The backup legal canon is, of course, review. Review of what government officials do. And we have that both inside government and inside the executive branch and at the courts. And what courts do is they look at a variety of things that are potential challenges to the legality of agency action. Courts, of course, tell you what the law says. They tell you what the parameters are of agency jurisdiction and authority. They tell you what the law means. And if an agency has authority to act and has some degree of discretion in doing it, the courts also tell you whether the agency has exercised the discretion appropriately. The Administrative Procedure Act in Section 706, I'm sure many of you are sitting there thumbing through your handheld copy of the APA. The Administrative Procedure Act spells out the six different things that you look for when you are reviewing agency action to make sure that it's lawful. Not only does it have to be within the statutory jurisdiction and authority, but if the agency is exercising discretion, discretion has to be exercised in a reasonable way. It can't be arbitrary. It can't be capricious. And those of you who have studied this carefully can do the essay on the difference between arbitrariness and capriciousness. And it can't be unreasonable in other ways. You have to have the right process. All of these are very well and carefully laid out in the law. So we come forward to Chevron. And in Chevron, the court says basically, you know, of course, the court tells you what the law is. If the law is clear, the court finds it. If the law isn't clear, then the agency obviously is being given some degree of discretion to act, and the court tells you whether the agency has acted reasonably. And had the court said that clearly and left it at that, we would not be here today. We wouldn't be discussing Chevron. Unfortunately, the court didn't say it that clearly, and after it said it more or less in that manner, said a whole lot of other things. It said about how, you know, obviously, if there's an ambiguity in the law, maybe Congress intended to delegate the legal interpretation of that to the agency. Congress doesn't give interpretation to the agency. It gives authority to the agency. It tells the agency what to do. The court went on to say in Chevron that there are a variety of things that could have been intended by the interest groups that were contesting over the law that was being written there. And it has a series of statements about how maybe the interest groups couldn't arrive at an accommodation. Maybe they decided to just take a chance on what the agency would do. They had comments in the law about how the scheme that was being administered in Chevron was making interstitial decisions. They went on and spelled out a lot of different factors that may have influenced what the court was doing. It becomes clear after you read the decision and then look at what the court has done over time that there are very different views of what the doctrine was about when it was being crafted. One view was that it was a doctrine that simply allowed the court to have a reasonable interpretation of the law and then a reasonable check on the exercise of discretion. Another view is that this is about institutional competence. It's about who is better prepared to make a decision in a certain sphere. And subsequent to Chevron, you have a third view that emerges, which is the view that this is really about markers for telling courts you can decide certain things and telling agencies we deputize you to replace courts in making certain interpretations of law. The court has had a very confusing jurisprudence post-Chevron, in part because Chevron itself rests on conflicting ideas of what to do, and in part because life is very complicated. There are many different things that influence the administration of the law, that influence how judges feel about the interpretations they're reviewing. And if you read through the decisions post-Chevron, you will see them sort of bobbing and weaving. A case like Massachusetts against the Environmental Protection Agency, I think, is fairly read as saying there are justices on the court who are worried about global warming. They don't care what the law is. They don't care what the rule of deference is. They're going to adopt a certain outcome, irrespective of all of the constraints in the law and in the precedents. There are other cases where you can make accusations that other judges who were on the dissenting side. But I think in Chevron, from Chevron through Mass v. EPA, there are some judges whose views cannot be lined up just according to the pronouncements in the law. One last thing before I sit down. Since Chevron, we also have had a revival of the Skidmore deference doctrine in Christensen and Mead. This is a doctrine that says we'll give Chevron deference in some cases. We'll say agencies are able to exercise discretion in some cases. In other cases, we're going to give a much more limited degree of deference because we're not going to find that there is anything in the law that really clearly lets the agency make certain decisions, or the agency hasn't made them in the right way, or it hasn't been given the right sort of law enforcement tools. I once explained the difference between Chevron and Skidmore this way. Chevron deference is what I give my wife. I defer to her because I know she's in charge and we're going to do it her way anyway. Skidmore deference is what my wife gives me. She will occasionally defer to me on issues where she already agrees with me and thinks that's what we ought to do. Thank you very much.
Okay, I want to resist our wonderful chair's suggestion. Maybe it was a statement, this is a boring topic, that doesn't generate passion. I think that's absolutely wrong. Among academics, there are passionate debates. Much gas has been expended on Chevron. And within the court, the debates are passionate to the point of Armageddon. On the court, there is a wide debate. Justice Scalia believes, with the passion he brings to the abortion line of cases, that any final agency determination made by the commission, whatnot, should receive Chevron deference. And as you know, Justice Scalia, who is an operatic justice at the very best, will sometimes argue that legal Armageddon has occurred if the right deference approach is not used. Whereas, on the other hand, Justice Breyer is sort of universal Skidmore. Justice Breyer is any agency decision he gets, whatever approach he's following. It's sort of like, well, so what do we have? Well, they seem to be very expert. We'll look at that. And how long-standing is their interpretation? That's relevant. Have they been delegated authority? I'll look at that. Do I agree? Is it reasonable? And so even his Chevron opinions are often written with that Skidmore kind of edge. And these two justices are very passionate, as are some of the justices in between them. So there's a great debate on this topic, and I'm going to talk about it empirically. And in fact, I wrote an article on the empirics of Chevron at the Supreme Court level. So Professor Hickman has written on the courts of appeals. I've written on the Supreme Court level. And here is the fact. We looked at 1,015 cases between Chevron and Hamdan. And here is what the cases tell us statistically. The first thing they tell us is the following, is that it is simply incorrect to believe that there is a Chevron regime and then there is no deference. That is simply wrong. In practice, the Supreme Court has followed no fewer than seven different regimes, as well as the no deference regime. So there have been anti-deference regimes, such as the rule of lenity, and we're only looking at what the Supreme Court actually says it's doing. Okay? Then there's no regime, and we have the percentage of cases in our 1,000-case sample, as well as the win rate for the agency under each regime. There's a regime we call Skidmore Light, where the Supreme Court cites no deference regime, cites no deference case, but our reading of the briefs and the agency's submissions suggests that the distinctive points made by the agency are critically relied on by the court, usually with explicit citations to the Solicitor General's brief. As you see, a lot of cases fall under this Skidmore light, and the win rate is quite astounding. Skidmore, which Dean Kass described, sort of look at the kitchen sink approach, a lot of cases. Beth Israel is a pre-Chevron, pre-83-84 set of cases tied to specific areas like tax, and treaties and labor areas. And Beth Israel, in fact, was a labor case. Those regimes have survived after Chevron. In other words, often the Supreme Court will not cite Chevron at all, but will cite Beth Israel or National Muffler or one of these earlier cases. Chevron, 8% of the cases, with a very good win rate for the agency. Skidmore Rock, or Seminole Rock, is the old case that says we should give super deference when an agency is interpreting its own rules. And then Curtis Wright, as you well know, or should know, is the old case that says we should give super-duper deference when the president or the executive is interpreting a statute in the foreign affairs arena. And so there's, see, there's some cases there with an astounding 100% win rate. Observations on what we call, so there is nothing, in my opinion, that is a Chevron era. This is not a Chevron era. This is an era of a continuum of deference. I think that's a fact. Okay, here are some observations we draw from the brute facts that we found. Aside from the fact that they obviously follow a variety of regimes, we make the, I think, banal observation, but apparently surprising to 99% of scholars, that the dominant regime, both before Meade and after Meade, has been Skidmore. Skidmore never died. It never went away. It never declined. It is dominant. It remains dominant. The dominant regime, I repeat, is Skidmore, which, if you count the Skidmore-like cases, is one quarter of the cases, and where the win rate is an astounding rate of about 78-79% when you put them together. And then here's a further irony. In more than half the cases, the Supreme Court applied no regime at all. They simply applied the ordinary reasoning that they apply. And we reached that conclusion even after having read the briefs as well as whatever agency materials were before the court. Moreover, we found that the Supreme Court applied the primary formalist regimes, Curtis Wright, Seminole, and Chevron, in only a fraction of the eligible cases. So, for example, Curtis Wright was applied in only about 10% of the cases that actually did involve foreign affairs and national security. Seminole was applied in only 7% of the cases that actually did involve an agency interpretation of its own rule. Even though justices sometimes become hysterical when Seminole Rock is not applied, the justices themselves only applied in a tiny fraction of the cases where it is formally applicable. And Chevron is applied in a little bit over 28% of the eligible cases. If you take the narrow Meade definition, the eligible cases are only where there's been a congressionally delegated lawmaking power. Okay? Now, note that Chevron was also applied in 9 cases where there had been no congressional delegation of lawmaking authority to the agency. So Chevron is both applied only in a small fraction of the cases where it's eligible, even under a liberal definition of eligibility, and then it's sometimes applied in cases where I could not figure out why it had been applying. Patterns of application. And here's some data on that if you want to predict. If there has been a congressional delegation of lawmaking authority under a liberal approach, Professor Merrill has a more conservative approach, it would be pretty similar under that, but maybe a little bit more. Supreme Court is about 28% likely to apply Chevron. The likelihood of applying Chevron goes up significantly if the agency interpretation is longstanding. That's a Skidmore approach. But it goes up significantly, even more if it's encoded through notice and comment rulemaking. The agency is interpreting its own jurisdiction or authority. Interestingly, the Supreme Court is 34% likely to apply Chevron, even though there's a lively debate whether Chevron even applies to jurisdiction or authority issues. We also looked at types of statutes, and we found that Chevron is especially likely to be applied when the statute involves telecommunications, health and safety, social entitlements like Social Security, environment, transportation, labor relations. Hypothesis. The doctrinal regimes themselves, in our opinion, such as Chevron and Seminole Rock, are not doing most, and maybe not any, of the analytical work when an agency interpretation is born before the U.S. Supreme Court. The court's announcement of a regime is influenced by a number of factors. The announced test, in other words, has been there been a delegation. The form of agency action, is it rulemaking? The justice authoring the opinion, Breyer less likely than Scalia, and most importantly, whether the Supreme Court is actually accepting the agency's interpretation. Hypothesis, they're citing Chevron and following the regime when they're already predisposed to accept the agency's interpretation. So if it's not the deference test, as it emphatically is not, what is influencing the judge's willingness to follow the agency? In our opinion, there are 3 factors. Factor number 1 is subject area. Agencies tend to win, even at the Supreme Court level, which only gets the hardest cases, if they're arguing areas, and this is irregardless of whether they're applying a deference regime, they're arguing areas where that are technical and instrumental, and where the justices don't care very much. Well, like bankruptcy, like business regulation, like foreign affairs. The justices realize they're not competent in foreign affairs. Like tax. Sorry about that. They're not competent in tax, transportation, telecommunications, IP, pensions, energy. These are instrumental areas. The agencies have huge win rates in most of those areas at the Supreme Court. Conversely, low win rates in areas that are primarily normative, like Indian law, civil rights, labor, criminal, issues involving the federal government. Point number two, what influences the justice? Process strongly influences the justice, irregardless of the regime. Irregardless, that's in the dictionary. Legislative rule. Those who have ruled, 72% win rate. Even better than formal adjudication and informal agency action, which are pretty healthy win rates themselves. If it's a longstanding interpretation, much higher win rate. If it's notice and comment rulemaking pursuant to a congressional delegation of lawmaking authority, 81% win rate. That's the process that gets you more. Third thing that influences the justices, are they sympathetic to what the agency is doing? With our 1,015 cases, we ran analyses of the justices' voting records and their responses to conservative versus liberal agency interpretations. You can see the data there. We can talk about it in greater detail. It ought to surprise you, not enormously, that Justices Breyer and Ginsburg agree much more when they're liberal agency interpretations than when they're conservative. Justices Scalia and Thomas agree much more when they're conservative agency interpretations and not liberal. So for another axiom we would draw from that is that the nation's leading textualists, i.e. Scalia and Thomas, are not constrained by the text. They interpret the text systematically to support conservative interpretations. The nation's leading supporters of legislative history, Breyer and Stevens, are not constrained by legislative history. They bend legislative history to support liberal interpretations. Using text and using legislative history are like looking out over the crowd and picking out your friends. Hypothesis. Supreme Court's willingness to go along, you thought this was not going to be controversial, with an agency's interpretation is less driven by the formal regime than by, number one, the justices' understanding of their comparative competence, number two, the deliberative process followed or not by the agency, and number three, whether the justices agree with or sympathetic to the agency's bottom line. And then finally, what should be the Supreme Court's deference regime? Because I emphatically, I think, have established in this article that they are not following any regime very systematically. In my opinion, what they are doing and probably what they should do at the Supreme Court level is a functional approach. Their level of deference to agency interpretation should be, and in fact is driven by, number one, whether the agency's view is consistent with larger public norms like federalism. Number two, whether the agency's view has been the result of a deliberative process pursuant to a congressional delegation. And number three, whether the agency has applied a special expertise that seems to carry forth the congressional purposes. This is the most important. Now, if they're stuck with Chevron, which they are, and they're not going to overrule it, that's fine. What I would insist upon is they've got to simplify the continuum, get rid of a lot of the detritus. They certainly have to clarify Chevron's domain. And in fact, I think it would be very useful for the court, Justice Breyer, et cetera, to start putting appendices. Well, here's where we have applied Chevron. Here are the statutes. We're going to do it in the future. So read the appendix and let's add to it. In my opinion, Chief Justice Roberts, or perhaps Justice Scalia, should be a little bit more of a monitor of whether they're applying deference regimes. And often, if you get concurring opinions, like in legislative history, it will influence the way the majority writes the opinion. And then I would tie Skidmore deference explicitly to the factors that I think are already at work, the rule of law factors, coherence, the process factors, and the expertise factors that I've identified above. If you want to know more, there is a plug. Thank you.
I hope to add to the discussion today with three points. First, in discussing Chevron or any other deference doctrine for that matter, I think it's important to distinguish between the Supreme Court and the courts of appeals. I think Bill and Ron are absolutely right. The Supreme Court's jurisprudence in this area is something of a mess. And I think that Bill's research demonstrates quite nicely that, contrary to some of its own rhetoric, the Supreme Court does not really seem to regard Chevron as much of a constraint upon its authority at all. There are a few reasons why I think this is the case. The first is that, as a matter of theory, the justices do have very different conceptions of how Chevron does and ought to work. Justice Scalia, as was mentioned, believes in a broad Chevron standard that extends a strong mandatory judicial deference to virtually any agency action that can be plausibly labeled as authoritative. Yet, Justice Scalia also rarely defers under Chevron because he has such an expansive view of Chevron step one that he rarely finds a statute to be ambiguous. Meanwhile, in opinions like Christensen and Mead and Brand X, Justices Thomas and Souter articulate a rather formalistic approach with a more limited Chevron that only applies to a comparatively narrow subset of agency actions that has a robust but not quite so expansive Chevron step one, and that has Skidmore as a meaningful alternative evaluative standard. Justice Breyer, by contrast, has articulated a fairly mushy, functionalist view of deference doctrine that lumps Chevron and Skidmore and presumably all the other standards that Bill identifies into a single multi-factor standard, with Chevron merely supplying additional factors for consideration. In the meantime, Chevron and Skidmore and Mead and the rest really only provide standards or a framework for analyzing the substantive statutory questions that these cases raise, rather than dictating particular outcomes. And in many cases, deference doctrine simply is not going to alter the justices' ultimate conclusions. So long as this is the case, so long as the justices' different conceptions of Chevron do not clash outright to yield different results, the court is going to focus on other things, like achieving greater unanimity in its opinions, or rather than getting too excited about the rhetorical nuances of deference language and this rather arcane debate over exactly how Chevron does and ought to work. The courts of appeals, I would suggest, are different. To a great extent, I find that the courts of appeals take deference doctrine much more seriously, not so much in pursuit of theoretical purity, but as a matter of at least attempted fidelity to Supreme Court guidance. The courts of appeals at least attempt to make some sense of the Supreme Court's rhetoric, and they're much more likely to view Chevron in particular as limiting their authority vis-a-vis the agencies. The courts of appeals aren't always consistent in applying Chevron. How could they be, given the Supreme Court's inconsistencies? But you see cases, and there are quite a few of them, actually, where the courts of appeals say, you know, if we were to decide this question ourselves, if we were just interpreting this statute for the first time on our own, we might decide this case differently. But the agency's interpretation was promulgated through notice and comment, it's within the realm of reasonableness, and Chevron requires us to defer. Or, post-Mead, it is not at all unusual to find an opinion involving informal agency action where a court of appeals says, you know, we understand where the agency's coming from. We see how they're getting their interpretation. We appreciate their concerns. And were this interpretation articulated in a notice and comment format, well, then we might defer under Chevron. But that's not what we have in front of us. The agency hasn't pursued the procedural formalities. Skidmore applies, and we just think the regulated party's interpretation is the better one. So the agency loses. And that brings me to the second main point that I want to make today, this one about Chevron's scope and the significance of Mead. It's generally accepted that the Supreme Court, in deciding Chevron, did not think that it was changing the face of administrative law. Strong deference in the vein of Chevron Step 2 had existed for decades, albeit for a comparatively small subset of agency regulations promulgated pursuant to specific grants of rulemaking authority. Regulations that historically had comprised the subset, the sum total of legislative rules. But with the expansion of rulemaking in the 1960s and the 1970s, agencies started employing general authority grants, authorizing all necessary rules and regulations to promulgate regulations that everyone treated in practice as legally binding. Tom Merrill, in his work with Catherine Watts, documents this evolution quite thoroughly. And historically, regulations premised on general authority were understood to be non-binding interpretive rules worthy only of Skidmore deference. But modern practice and understandings shifted to render these regulations indistinguishable from legislative rules. The rule at issue in Chevron was one of these regulations, premised on general authority, promulgated pursuant to notice and comment, and believed by the agency and regulated parties to be legally binding. Extending strong deference to regulations such as these, as the court did in Chevron, was a shift, but it was hardly an earthquake given the evolution of modern practice and understandings of what these regulations were doing. But the court's rhetoric in Chevron, Ron's absolutely right, talking about implied delegations and expertise and democratic accountability, was sufficiently vague and open-ended to allow ultimately for Chevron to grow into something much, much more. Now, remember Justice Scalia's view of Chevron's scope. Starting at the D.C. Circuit and then moving on to the Supreme Court, Justice Scalia did an absolutely marvelous job, I think, of influencing colleagues toward his point of view, at least rhetorically. And the courts allowed Chevron to grow case by case through application until it was at least perceived as consuming the field and applying to a vast array of agency actions. By the time you get to the late 1990s, this pushing of Chevron's boundaries was raising lots of questions, generating several circuit splits that Tom and I have documented in our work together. And with Meade and to a lesser extent its predecessor, Christensen v. Harris County, particularly as the courts of appeals have applied those cases, the court has more or less carved back the scope of Chevron's applicability to a much narrower range of agency actions that I think roughly approximate what the court thought it was doing with Chevron in the first place. Finally, a few words on whether at the end of the day Chevron is a good thing. I think it is, although with a few caveats. Shoehorning the modern administrative state into traditional understandings of constitutionally separated powers has been tough. And it's been something that the courts have largely been forced to do piecemeal and on the fly as the nature and roles of agencies has changed over time. Sure, traditionally the courts have been the primary arbiters of what statutes mean. But Congress also used to do more, I think, in adopting these statutes. Or at least agencies seem to have done less in interpreting them. The bottom line being that a lot of what agencies do now nominally fits into the definition of statutory interpretation, but really, I think, represents policy choice. The Chevron case itself is a prime example. As changing administrations with different priorities vacillated between broader and narrower conceptions of what was a stationary source, Congress could have made a definitional choice. Instead, it punted that choice to the agency. I think it's folly to argue that the Clean Air Act is clear on this particular point. And so long as Congress is going to avoid making some of these decisions, as long as our concept of the non-delegation doctrine allows Congress to punt these choices to either the agencies or the courts, well, that's the choice that we've got. Either the agencies are going to have to make the choice or the courts are. As somebody who takes seriously the ideas of judicial restraint and comparative democratic accountability, I think you have to leave these policy choices to the agencies. The alternative, in my mind, is judicial activism in the regulatory sphere of the sort that we Federalists decry in the constitutional sphere. But here are my caveats. My belief in Chevron deference presumes a meaningful Chevron Step 1 analysis. Too often, I think the courts are willing to abdicate responsibility for grappling with statutory language to find meaning. As a judge I know once put it, some courts would find ambiguity at a stop sign. And that's a problem. And second, the courts have to take seriously the link between deference and the procedural protections afforded by notice and comment, formal adjudication, and the like. Hard look review has a role here, too. That sort of review of agency process has its own issues and potential for mischief, but I consider that to be a separate problem that we just have to address separately. In sum, I see the Chevron doctrine as a meaningful doctrine that serves a valid purpose but shouldn't be a blank check. Thanks.
Thanks. Well, I'm going to pick up on some of the themes that have been raised in the other comments and make them more explicit, which is the relationship between Chevron and the Chevron regime and the question of the constitutional order. Now, if Chevron had just announced a new standard of review and a new interpretation of the Administrative Procedure Act, I don't think that it would have attracted nearly as much interest among both practicing lawyers and academics as it has. Chevron, of course, has become probably the most widely cited administrative law decision of all time and certainly the most written about administrative law decision of all time. And I think the reason for this is not technical or practical so much as the implications that Chevron seemed to have for our understanding of the constitutional order, particularly for separation of powers, but also indirectly for federalism questions. And to reinforce some of the suggestions that the other speakers have made, I think Chevron can be seen as marking the official death of the traditional non-delegation doctrine. And I think this was why, to some extent, it was so disconcerting to people. And what I would like to suggest to you is that over the last 25 years, as the court has struggled with the implications of the official internment of the non-delegation doctrine, that it has come around almost full circle to articulate what I will call a new delegation doctrine in the course of explicating the scope of the Chevron doctrine, and that this new delegation doctrine is something that we ought to take extremely seriously in our understanding of the nature of the Constitution going forward into a new century. So the traditional non-delegation doctrine, as you're all aware, sort of has basic premises that Congress is the policy-making entity in the government. Congress sets the policy. Congress can delegate some discretionary authority to agencies, but it can only do so if the agency's discretion is confined by an intelligible principle. And that courts have an important role to play in making sure that the agency complies with this intelligible principle. Chevron, in many respects, seemed to many readers to repudiate this traditional non-delegation understanding, and some of the other speakers have already alluded to some of this. Chevron talked about express delegations from Congress to agencies to interpret statutory provisions, citing Batterson versus Francis, and then without virtually taking a breath, moved on to say, of course, sometimes delegations can be implied as well as expressed, suggesting that there was an equation between implied and express delegations, something that seems out of place under the traditional non-delegation doctrine. Perhaps more importantly, Chevron seemed to say that agency power increases as congressional guidance diminishes. The traditional non-delegation doctrine seems to say that agencies only have authority to act if their discretion is constrained by intelligible principles. Chevron seems to say that the more Congress leaves undecided, leaves unaddressed, or ambiguous, the more power the agency has. And finally, as a number of other speakers, I think Ron made express allusion to this, there's a famous passage at the end of the Chevron opinion where the court said that Congress has all sorts of reasons for delegating to agencies, agency expertise, maybe they didn't think about the question. And then, rather astonishingly, the court said, it may be that Congress was unable to forge a coalition on either side of the question, and those on each side decided to take their chances with the scheme devised by the agency. Now, this is enough to curl the hair of any traditional non-delegation partisan. What the court is essentially saying is that Congress is free, if it wants to punt, to abdicate its responsibility and let an administrative agency decide the issue. So for all these reasons, I think, as my colleague Jerry Mishaw has put it, Chevron was the final nail in the non-delegation coffin. So what happens? 25 years of case decision-making happens, and gradually over time, the court's understanding of the occasions on which Chevron deference is appropriate begins to solidify a little bit, and there are some statements in the cases to the effect that Chevron deference is, of course, dependent upon a delegation of interpretive authority from the agency. And then ultimately, in a quadrant of extremely important opinions decided more recently, Christensen, Mead, Brandeis, and Gonzales versus Oregon, the court has much more clearly announced that the domain of Chevron is restricted by a threshold inquiry that essentially asks whether or not the right delegation of authority has been made to the agency. So the court has circled back around from sort of interring the non-delegation doctrine to resurrecting it. Although the resurrection has taken the form of a specter that is not exactly equal to the one that was put into the tomb. This new non-delegation doctrine is encapsulated in what Kristen Hickman and I called step zero of Chevron. This is the kind of threshold inquiry that the court is supposed to make before deciding whether to apply Chevron. There are basically three questions implicated in step zero. First, did Congress delegate to the agency authority over this particular question at issue? In other words, does the agency have jurisdiction over this issue? Secondly, did Congress give the agency authority to act with the force of law with respect to this particular issue? Agencies don't have inherent authority to make legal propositions and coerce people with the force of law. It has to be given to them by Congress. And thirdly, did the agency take whatever steps are necessary to act with the force of law in making policy in this particular area? So these three questions, which are set forth reasonably clearly in cases like Mead and Brandeis, although I will fully admit obscured by other efforts like those of Justice Breyer, are what I would claim represents a new non-delegation doctrine. Now, the new doctrine has some similarities with the traditional doctrine, but also some very important differences. What are the similarities? First of all, both the traditional doctrine and the new doctrine understand that the executive has no inherent authority to act in a regulatory fashion, that power has to be delegated to it by statute from Congress. There is no doctrine of executive or, for that matter, judicial lawmaking power, except in limited areas of constitutional grants of authority, perhaps under Article II. Secondly, that that agencies are limited in the scope of their authority to the jurisdiction that's been conferred to them by Congress. And if agencies act outside the scope of that jurisdiction, their actions are ultra vires and are legally null and void. Thirdly, that judicial review is important. The judicial review is important to preserving the constitutional order. It's not simply some kind of detail, or as Scalia would have it, that sort of there's a blanket deference doctrine that applies to any authoritative decision by an agency. The new delegation doctrine understands that courts have a vital function to play in making sure that agencies do have delegated authority and are acting within the scope of that authority. And finally, it's understood that agency power flows from congressional clarity, not from congressional ambiguity. The clarity that matters now is the clarity in delegating authority to the agency, and clarity in expressing that the agency has the authority to act with the force of law, and clarity in setting forth the procedural requirements the agency has to follow in order to act with the force of law. So clarity comes back into the picture as an important element of agency power as it did under the traditional non-delegation doctrine. What are the differences? Some very important differences. First of all, Congress is no longer understood to be the entity that has to make policy. Policy making authority can be diffused throughout the structure of government. Congress has the option of being the primary policymaker if it wants to, and courts will enforce that under step one, but Congress is not compelled to render the key policy determinations under this new delegation doctrine. What's important is that Congress indicate who is to make policy, not so much what the policy is supposed to be. There is no requirement of an intelligible principle other than formally. The Supreme Court hasn't overruled the traditional non-delegation doctrine, but it has not in the last century or more, since the 1930s, found a statute that did not contain an intelligible principle. So I think functionally speaking, we can think that that traditional doctrinal element is no longer effective. Interestingly, under this new non-delegation doctrine, no explicit constitutional foundation for the idea of delegatory limits. The new delegation doctrine is a doctrine of administrative common law, not constitutional law, as was the traditional doctrine. So let me conclude quickly with some further thoughts about this and what we may see going forward. First of all, I think all this has some very important implications for Congress. Congress, as those of you who know, who have ever read the Constitution, is the first branch of government under the Constitution. The framers clearly thought it was the most important branch of government. It's clearly the one that's the most directly accountable to the people. But Congress has become a pathetic relic of what it was envisioned to be under the Constitution. It's become reactive rather than initiatory. It engages in things like oversight hearings and constituent services rather than attending to the making of policy. Members of Congress are concerned with finagling earmarks for their constituents and playing the blame game. All this, I think, is not something to be laughed about or mocked, but rather for people who care about the Constitution, something to be deeply mourned. We're not really being faithful to the Constitution if Congress is relegated to the role of being a kind of small-time fixer or ombudsman under our government. And I think that this new delegation doctrine, although it's very tentative and although it's expressed in non-constitutional terms, has within it the seeds of a new constitutional role for Congress that maybe Congress is institutionally capable of performing. I think the reason the non-delegation doctrine died, and other people have alluded to this, is that the size and scope of government just became too large for members of Congress to play the primary policymaking role. But maybe, just maybe, Congress could play the role of being the kind of orchestrator of government and deciding who is going to decide different policy questions. That entails less deliberation, less input of information. And after all, we need somebody to decide this, decide these issues. If policymaking power is diffused all over the government and includes the private entities as well as public and state as well as federal, we need to have some authoritative body that can decide ex ante and on a comprehensive basis who has decision-making authority over particular issues. And I can't think of any entity that really could perform that role on a consistent basis other than Congress. So I think this new non-delegation doctrine is pointing, hopefully, towards a new conception of Congress as the primary constitutional body under our government and has defined a new role for it in keeping with its dignity under the Constitution. Lastly, I'll just make a brief comment about the role of the courts in all this. I fully concede that these recent decisions by the court are not clearly articulated. There's been a lot of backsliding. There's a lot of internal disagreement about these things. The court itself doesn't really seem to understand the implications of what it is saying here in articulating the new delegation doctrine. But I think it's something worth nurturing and encouraging. And I think that ultimately it casts the courts in a very attractive role. The courts are admittedly engaged here in innovation, although it's sort of a cautious step-by-step innovation. They're engaged in constitutional engineering. And that may not be a good thing. But it's not the worst possible thing because it's constitutional engineering in support of an overall, a larger program that I think is fairly attractive. In other words, the courts are laying down a menu of signals, but they're not calling the signals themselves. They're saying these are the signals. If Congress follows these signals, Congress can dictate who makes policy. We will follow the signals of Congress. Now, whether Congress takes up the signals is another matter. Whether the courts will be faithful to the menu of signals they've articulated is another matter. But at least the vision, I think, is an appealing one, where the courts are saying, this is how we want to decide who decides. And you, Congress, have the authority to make the ultimate decisions, and you have authority to say who's going to make policy. And the ultimate policy will be made by people that are more accountable to the people, and are more sensitive to our larger constitutional values than if those policy decisions are made by the courts. And so I think it's a little bit of an unusual role for the courts to play. It's unusual for administrative common law to be articulating these fundamental principles of constitutional ordering. But I think we can perceive in the history of the Chevron Doctrine and the story of what's become of it, something like that may be afoot. Thank you.
Thank you so much, panel. This panel is unlike what I said before. Maybe there are some inflamed passions, but they're so civilized that, you know, and some people during the course of our telephone conversation to prepare for this panel clearly kept their powder dry, but I'm glad they brought it today. What an informed discussion. There's so much to talk about. There is a youngster somewhere here who has a microphone for those who want to ask questions. Before we get started with the audience's questions, though, I couldn't help but notice lots of very intense scribbling going on at the table by our panelists as other panelists were talking. Professor Cass, I have a sense that you'd like to ask a question or make a comment.
You talk about the changes in government. Obviously, a lot of the reason why deference becomes an issue is government has grown. It's grown enormously. We have lots more statutes. We have lots more rules and regulations. But one of the changes we've seen over time is the way we give policymaking power to people in government. If you go back to statutes that were written in the 1800s, like the one setting up the Interstate Commerce Commission, you see a clear delegation of power to set just and reasonable rates. Now, Congress isn't spelling out what a just and reasonable rate is. The only way to understand the statute is not that it's giving power to the ICC to interpret the law, unless you mean everything that any agency does is legal interpretation. It's clearly a delegation of discretionary power, but not absolute discretion. The difference today is that when Congress does things like that, it usually does it with a whole lot more words. We've seen very big, broad delegations of power. The authorization for the use of military force after 9/11 was essentially a statement: fix the problem, don't let us get attacked again, and we'll come back later and tell you if you've done it wrong. The TARP, the Troubled Asset Relief Program, again, despite having 431 provisions or so, that's a statement to the Secretary of the Treasury: here is something like $1 billion, more or less. It makes you a billion. I remind myself of the fellow in Austin Powers, I guess, that Dr. Evil, who comes back from Frozen and says, "I demand $1 million." You know, I remember a day when a billion was a big number, I guess. So we're $700 billion, almost $1 trillion, handed over to the Secretary of the Treasury and say, "Fix the problem, and then we'll tell you if you did it wrong." But the statutory framework, despite the broad delegations of power, the statutory framework is enough longer and more complicated to make a lot of things look like matters of statutory interpretation that really at bottom are not.
Professor Eskridge, you had a question for one of your colleagues.
Actually, I have a question for my Yale colleague, Professor Merrill. Is this on? Yeah, here's the question I have, and that is that I think there's a broader frame, Tom, and see where this fits into what you're talking about. In my opinion, what I'm finding at the Supreme Court level, and I think more broadly, is that deference was not born with Chevron. This has been a continuous process. And what's driving the fact that law is now made overwhelmingly by agencies and acquiesced in overwhelmingly by judges, nibbling away in some of the big cases, one is the massive point. I take that. I think that's maybe a big point. I think it is a big point. Second is the expertise point, which is a related thing for me. It's not just agencies know more, but judges don't care very much. They realize they don't know very much, and they don't really care very much, because they do care about civil rights and labor for whatever reason they do. But here's the third thing that we've not mentioned that I think actually is a big deal, and that's what political scientists like Terry Moe call the first mover advantage. And this is a larger phenomenon that we've seen really for the last 200 years, which is given, in effect, the president — Ron, this is your example of the bailout — it's given the president and the executive branch a lot more power than the framers envisaged, but power that's a result of the structure that the framers intentionally set up. That the president not only has expertise, and the executives under the president, but the president also has the ability to make the first move when there's a crisis or just a problem Here's a solution. And if it's a thoughtful solution, then what are judges going to do? They're going to strike it down because the commas are out of place? You know, occasionally they will, but not very often. So it seems to me the larger phenomenon that's going on, Tom, that's already upended the non-delegation doctrine. And I submit to you is going to upend the Merrill and Hickman juggernaut about, well, the one thing courts can enforce is jurisdictional limits. And I'm with Scalia. What do you mean jurisdictional limits? The authority given to the agency? How can you separate the jurisdiction and authority from all the other issues? You know, it's very difficult. And indeed, we found in our study, I found it very hard to categorize that. But yet about a quarter of the Chevron cases are jurisdiction or authority cases by my count. So it seems to me it's going to swallow even that up, Tom.
No, I don't think we should give up.
We might want to give up on the microphones.
it'll come around.
Use mine.
It's not got no cord attached to it. That's why it's not working. I don't think we should give up on the jurisdictional limits point. Although I think the Supreme Court, at least temporarily, has given up on it. I think they were kind of browbeaten in Mississippi Power and Light by Scalia into thinking that it was impossible for them to discern the difference between an agency acting within its jurisdiction and acting outside of its jurisdiction. Jonathan Adler, who's in the audience, has an interesting draft paper on this question, and maybe he could speak to this. But I think that that there are sort of simple intuitive tests for when agencies are acting outside of their jurisdiction or arguably acting outside of their jurisdiction, which are simply historical in nature. Agencies perform functions on a routine basis, and issues arise in the course of performing those functions that require interpretations. And I think everyone intuitively understands that those are within the agency's jurisdiction, at least as it has been kind of conventionally understood in an evolutionary fashion. And then all of a sudden something comes along that looks like it's a sudden quantum leap. You know, the agency wants to regulate cigarettes when it's never regulated cigarettes before. Or the Attorney General wants to control, assisted suicide when the attorney under the Controlled Substances Act, which he's never done before. And I think, when I ask my students, sometimes whether these are jurisdictional or non-jurisdictional questions, there's a great deal of consensus about what sort of issues are jurisdictional and which ones aren't. And I think the consensus comes from a perception that when an agency is purporting to shift from its established course in a kind of dramatic fashion, that people perceive that to be jurisdictional. And I think, it's not the clearest lie in the world, but I think it's one that's sort of strongly intuitive, and I think that part of the Step Zero inquiry should be that when an agency is doing that, the courts should feather back on the deference below the Chevron level and engage what amounts to kind of independent review to see whether or not it is within the scope of the agency's authority. I think Brown and Williamson was, in fact, a Step Zero case decided before Meade, and so it kind of reads differently, but I think that's essentially what the court intuited there.
Thank you. Let's go to questions and comments from the audience. Our microphone will wander around to each of you.
Tom, you've actually given me an insight, which is in many ways Mass versus EPA perhaps is really a jurisdictional case along those lines. Should the EPA move to a place it's never really gone in statutory interpretation? On the other hand, you could also interpret it as essentially embracing the new non-delegation ideal, where essentially, realistically, that policy has been thrown back for a legislative veto. Even with the advance notice of proposed rulemaking that's out there now, I think effectively the courts really have pushed a question at large back to the Congress. It's not exactly non-delegation, but it might be in an implicit way part of your common law non-delegation. But I think the problem is not Chevron myself. I think it's the progressive era decisions that underlie it. I think the decision that's wrong and that's several generations older is Caroline. I think that having a standard that effectively means plausible rather than persuasive, while that approximates the distinction between Chevron and Meade and in some way, I think it's that basis that should be revisited. It's whatever it is, the 65th anniversary of Caroline. That's personally where I'd like to be looking for direction, especially thinking that it was not true only in the economic realm. In that same era, you had Buck v. Bell. And even in the civil liberties context, and with great respect for Michael Crichton, who passed and who also recognized that decision, if I could take Justice Holmes' phrase, what I would say regards to Chevron, at least as it applies the Caroline standard, is three generations of idiocy are enough.
I'm with Ron on Mass v. EPA. I think anybody who really understands the way the Clean Air Act works would think that it would be nonsense for the EPA to try to regulate climate change under the current structure of the Clean Air Act. Therefore, the proposition that the EPA was supposed to regulate greenhouse gases under the motor vehicle provisions was a proposal that the agency exceed the understood scope of its regulatory jurisdiction. And the court should have ruled that way. Not a single justice perceived the case that way, to my great disappointment, perhaps because, again, they don't really understand the Clean Air Act that well. Your proposal is what I would characterize as a kind of catalyst theory, that sometimes, courts should sort of pretend that the plain language of the statute requires something in order to shake up the people in Washington and get them to sort of do something about the problem. So, the catalyst theory would suggest that in Brown and Williamson, the court should have said, yeah, sure, the FDA can regulate cigarettes, and they can ban the cigarettes tomorrow if they want to. And in fact, the statute probably requires they do this. And this would have really shaken up things in Washington. They would have had to finally pass a statute regulating cigarettes. And I think that's what the majority in Mass v. EPA was trying to do. They were trying. They took a statute that clearly doesn't fit climate change, sort of said that the literal terms do fit climate change, and then they're forcing the legislative process to act. I'm personally skeptical about this catalyst theory. I don't really know where courts get the authority to decide which issues ought to be put on the agenda and which ones ought not to be put on the agenda. On Caroline products, I mean, that's a power grab by the court trying to describe a new role for itself in a certain delimited areas of policy involving civil rights and so forth. But I think I would prefer to see them be deferential across the board.
Question?
Professor Merrill, to the extent that the Chevron model and even the new delegation model has as its underpinning the constitutional idea that the executive has sort of no independent authority before Congress lends authority, how well does that model fit for areas where the executive does have some independent authority, such as foreign affairs or defense? So if you have defense regulations or if you have State Department regulations or anything plausibly touching on foreign affairs or defense, is it fair to say that Chevron should apply, and if it shouldn't apply, should you have some other model that takes into account actually the executive does have some authority to move in the first instance here, and if there is a model, is it just Justice Jackson's model, or is there anything more robust that we can say?
I kind of like Justice Black's opinion myself, basically, the president has to trace his authority from a provision of the Constitution or a statute, otherwise he doesn't have authority. It's for Congress to decide. I would say that in the Article II area that the president does have some default powers. The commander-in-chief power, for example, is a default power. If Congress has provided for an army and a navy but has not said anything about how they should be led or disciplined and so forth, the president's commander-in-chief power would give him an inherent authority to do that. I do think, though, that if Congress has legislated in these areas, that the president is bound to comply with the statutes of Congress. I think that's the way our Constitution is designed. And I don't agree with the Bush administration's extravagant claims for inherency that supersede congressional legislation.
Yeah, I think the question, though, is what does Congress require? And in my opinion, that's very often very ambiguous. And so what level of deference should apply? Now, the Supreme Court's announced doctrine is Curtis Wright. You know, that was a statutory interpretation case. People don't remember that. That was a case where Justice Sutherland held Congress has authorized this excursion by the president in this foreign affairs arena. And then he does have this discussion, I think in dictum, about the president's inherent powers there. So it seems to me that if you want to describe what the theoretical doctrine is, it is Curtis Wright, which is a kind of super deference. And I will also say, in the last 22 years, whenever they've applied Curtis Wright, 100% of those cases the president has won. Now, you may recall that was the debate in Hamdan. Hamdan, which was the military commission's case, was a statutory interpretation case. And it was whether or not very broadly drafted congressional legislation prohibited the president from establishing the military commissions he set up. Justice Thomas applied Curtis Wright deference and found that the president was authorized by the statute. Justice Stevens did not apply, I think he applied Skidmore light, is the way we would categorize it. It was very light deference, and he found that the statute did not authorize the president. Okay? So again, it's endogenous. The level of regime that you adopt is endogenous to the process by which you think about the issue. I would say this, however, normatively, which I think is the clear answer, and that is, again, I'm the functionalist, an area where the first mover advantage is particularly important is one where the president fact will and ought should have a lot of discretion in applying whatever the framework is that Congress has passed. Okay? So it seems to me, and that maps rather well to the Article II authority that you find in the Commander-in-Chief Clause. And I really highly recommend Sai Prakash and Michael Ramsey's excellent article on, it's a broader, it's a very ambitious argument, going further than the Bush administration in some ways, for a plenary presidential power in the foreign affairs area from constitutional text and history. And that would be very congenial with Curtis Wright. So, but again, I'd say functionally, first mover.
Ron?
I think actually both questions emphasize the fact that there are a lot of different things that go into the decision, particularly as Bill said and as you underscored, Kristen, at the Supreme Court level. And when you're dealing with a question like global warming, where they not only throw out the statutory understanding, but they deal with a provision that says that this is only something that can be done if in the judgment of the administrator he determines that this is contributing to pollution. They said, well, we're not going to credit that because we don't like his judgment. We're throwing out every reason he's given and saying, well, go back and give us new reasons. Or if you talk about a case like Hamdan, you have a series of cases where the Supreme Court is dealing with constructions of statutory authority, where the Court of Appeals, and I won't compliment Judge Randolph, who kept getting it right and getting reversed and then having the Supreme Court reversed by Congress. The question is, what did Congress say? The Court of Appeals looks at the law and says, here's what it said. The Supreme Court looks at the same law and says, well, we're going to do a very nice circle around that to arrive at a meeting we think is more congenial. And then Congress comes back and says, no, we meant what we said the first time. You know, obviously, when you deal with the sort of high-profile, contentious issues that get to the Supreme Court, you are dealing with cases where so many factors are influencing the outcome of the decision, no single stated regime of deference is going to explain what the court is doing. But it would be nice if we had a way of talking about these cases that was closer to what the courts were actually doing when they said, here's how we arrive at our decisions.
Kristen.
One last point with respect, getting back to particularly the national security foreign affairs point, and I think this is backed up a little bit with respect to the Curtis Wright standard. I think especially if you see, as I do, a link between procedure and Chevron deference, it's important to point out that Congress has recognized, I think, that this is a special area in that they have exempted from notice and comment rulemaking. I forget the precise language in Section 553, but there's an exception for it's military affairs or national security, or there's some formulation like that in the Administrative Procedure Act itself that says we're not, you know, that where Congress carves that out and says the normal processes that we expect agencies to pursue for purposes of lawmaking don't apply in that area. And I think that's a very important recognition by Congress that just then fits with Curtis Wright. And, you know, the court's perception that that's just different.
We have another question from the audience.
Thanks for being here. I had a slightly different question. I don't really practice in the administrative law context all that much, but I do litigate against the government quite a bit in government contracts. And what I want to ask is whether private litigants can sometimes use Chevron type of interpretations offensively against the government. You can have a client that thinks he has a contract with the government, and that is good as far as the language goes, but there are isolated instances where the government might say, well, wait a minute, that's also a regulation. It might be part of the federal acquisition regulation, for example. Some of these instances involve when the government says, well, you need to owe, the court needs to pay some deference to the government's interpretation. So the question is more general than just the government contracts context, but are there situations where the government doesn't proffer some sort of Chevron interpretation or, for that matter, a Seminole Rock type of interpretation, but a private litigant can? Thank you.
Professor Eskridge, I'd like you to take that in your Justice Breyer invitation.
Well, yes. I believe we follow a multi-factor approach, none of which is at all either determinant or even comprehensible. Well, here's what I would say. I would say, number one, you have different categories of cases. Well, number one would be cases where the government position is at odds with itself. You might have more than one agency, right? And you do have a lot of those cases. In fact, you're going to see more of those cases at the Supreme Court level in our lifetime because you have a proliferation of agencies, you have proliferation regulations, so on and so forth. So the first category of cases is going to be those where the government is at odds with itself. And, of course, as you know, if it gets to the Supreme Court, the Solicitor General is going to have to arbitrate that and probably rile one of the agencies. And, by the way, sometimes you even see within an agency there are cases involving OSHA. So you've got the OSHA itself, and then you've got the adjudicatory body, and sometimes they're at odds with one another. So that's one place. Second place, and you see this often in tax, if I may use a tax example, defer to you all.
Do.
No, I defer. You're the tax folks. But I also, in the tax area, you do very often see situations where a rule clearly supports the taxpayer, or seems to, but the IRS is taking an interpretation of that rule or that whatever that, in your case, obviously doesn't support you. And those cases come out all sorts of different ways. Generally speaking, the court does not, in the tax cases, invoke Seminole Rock. The IRS wins most of its cases, but not for that reason. So sometimes you get that, where the rule, and maybe the rule has been interpreted, actually, by the agency differently, and now they've changed their interpretation of their own rule, right? And they lose some of those cases.
Yeah.
They lose some of those cases. Yeah. They don't have such a great rate in those cases. So it seems to me that's a second kind of category where you could use that. And then it seems to me a third one, and you see this in some Scalia opinions, and this is what I would urge practitioners to do. I like this idea of administrative common law, is that sometimes Kennedy did this in the Bragdon case, to give you this as an example. Bragdon involved an interpretation of the Americans with Disabilities Act, which is actually implemented by a whole variety of agencies. DOJ has a lot of formal responsibilities, but actually a variety of agencies, maybe as many as one or two dozen agencies, actually have either rules or guidances or whatnot, interpreting the ADA, what is a disability, and so on and so forth. And Kennedy, and it was unruly. Not all the agencies had gone the same way. So shop the agencies, you know, et cetera. Now, Kennedy used what he thought was a rough consensus of what the agencies were saying as to one or two issues and got some guidance for that. But really, agencies are like herding cats, and typically if more than one agency has addressed the same kind of issue, you are going to get slightly different treatment. Justice Scalia has done that in a couple of cases where he'll take an analogous agency regulation and reason from that, even though it's not on point. You know, again, it's a source of guidance for a justice, particularly if it's an issue on which there is not much formal legal guidance. So they're reasoned by analogy.
Professor Hickman.
There is this doctrine called the Accardi Doctrine, which is not used a lot recently, but it says that agencies have to follow their own regulations. So if you can find a regulation that embodies this position, the agency can be zapped under that principle. An interesting question would be, what if the agency has interpreted its regulation or interpreted the law in a Chevron-eligible fashion, but has not embodied this interpretation in the text of a regulation? But there, I think, at the very least, you could say that a departure from that was clearly arbitrary and capricious, if not given with the type of explanation that we require for departures from agencies settled in understandings of the law. So those would be the two tools I would look to do battle with an agency in that context.
And a final point on that from Professor Hickman.
One other thing you might want to be aware of, at least as of about 10 years ago, there was a slight circuit split. I mean, not a, it wasn't extensive, but there were opinions out there that were conflicting among the circuits about the extent to which Chevron deference was due to agency interpretations of state common law, like contract law, when it came to interpreting contracts. I think most of those cases involve the agency as sort of a neutral reviewer of a contract between two different parties, both under its jurisdiction. But some of those may have been government contract cases. Now, in a post-Meade era, of course, you know, Congress doesn't delegate to an agency the authority to interpret state common law, you know, so I think that that's a good argument for Chevron not applying in those contexts. But nevertheless, it is a body of jurisprudence that you might want to look into.
Judge Morrison.
Hi. The National Muffler opinion contains a number of factors for the court to take into account in determining whether to defer to agency, whether to defer to agency interpretations. And one of those is whether the interpretation is longstanding. Do you think that that factor is a good thing to look at? Anyone on the panel who has an opinion?
Well, I think if you have a longstanding interpretation, certainly it's one that people will have relied on more. It will have obviously been tested more in terms of how it works in practice. So if you're looking at this as sort of a prediction of policy, yes, long-standing interpretation should be given more credit. The same way, on the other hand, the courts have said, if you're going to change your interpretation, you're going to change your view, tell us clearly that you're doing it and why you're doing it. Don't just do something that's inconsistent with it. And that makes sense as well.
Let me just add to that. The long-standing thing is not just National Muffler. It's explicitly in Skidmore. And the Chevron cases, even though it's not the Chevron standard, the Chevron cases, you do get a bump if it says long-standing. Of course, Barnhart, written by Breyer. Beryl doesn't like talking about Barnhart. Barnhart emphasizes that it was a long-standing interpretation. The emphasis I would make that's extremely important, it seems to me, when you talk about reliance, there can be public reliance as well as private reliance. So this is not just reliance by the regulated industry, but also reliance maybe by the agency itself. If it's the center of a web of rules that are interconnected, that gives it a certain cachet. Courts will be and ought to be more reluctant to pluck that out. And then secondly, it might actually have been relied on by Congress if it's one of these statutes that it actually is revisited. Have they built upon that rule? That was the Babbitt case. That's what decides the Babbitt case, in my opinion. That's Sweet Home, the Endangered Species Act case. What decides it is really the 1982 amendment, where Congress basically took the Department of the Interior's rule, said, okay, that's going to be the rule, but we want to create an administrative mechanism to create allowance for exceptions for farmers and whatnot, for whom it would be burdensome to follow the rule.
Is there one more question? All right, this will be our last question.
Our founding father set up a constitution supposedly with limited powers to the federal government, and accordingly they made it less dynamic. They split the legislative power into two houses. Some point along the line, the Supreme Court gave federal government power to regulate in nearly every area that there is, with just a couple pushbacks in Lopez and Morrison recently. And we've also had this massive proliferation of agencies where federal government has its finger in just about every single policy area that there is in the country. And for good or ill, the APA is set up to be a relatively non-dynamic way to make rules or to respond to rules. So when we have a crisis caused by government regulation, like the banking crisis that we're having right now, doesn't seem to me that we have the luxury of going through an APA type of notice and comment period as to whether giving $700 billion to the Secretary of Treasury is a good idea, or even any possible way to have meaningful judicial oversight of what happens to fix a big problem like that. And we see that in the Navy sonar case, where even in the judicial review, it came up on a preliminary injunction. They didn't have a trial. And it still went its way to a year before it got to the Supreme Court. And the courts aren't getting any more dynamic. In fact, with the splits, they're getting smaller and less able to handle these. So with the massive amount of agencies, same amount of court resources, what does that portend in the future to meaningful judicial review of issues that the people are going to expect the government to fix? because they cause the problems.
Professor Eskridge,
the court, Hamilton said it. I know it's not, he's not your hero. Madison's the hero, but Hamilton's the one who said it. The courts are the least dangerous branch, and they're becoming less dangerous over time. Because the brute, and you can tie to the Constitution, the structure set up by the Constitution, is the courts are reactive, and they don't have their own resources, they don't have their own tax base, etc. Congress potentially has the power, but I would maintain, and this is the political science view, that the president and the executive, which can include agencies, because of their first mover advantages, have accumulated more and more power over time. And here's the response. But I don't recommend it, and I don't think it's going to happen. The response would be, if the courts wanted to push back, they would have to write broader opinions. And the reason they're not going to do it is that they wrote broader opinions challenging wider swaths of what agencies were doing. They would get into more trouble. And the judiciary has a yellow streak down its back that is a mile long. They do get into trouble occasionally, and they don't believe they deserve it. They usually lose when they get into trouble with new personnel or whatnot. And indeed, you see the judges groveling today. There's no other way to put it. Groveling some, for a pay raise.
Some, please. There are exceptions. Professor Cass.
I would just add that while there has been some change in the power, these things do go through cycles. You do have periods where Congress is much more assertive of its prerogatives and its authority. And I wouldn't, Bill, understate the damage judges can do. They may be the least dangerous branch, but they're not without their own dangers. So I think we will see many instances where the courts will aggressively intervene, and I think we have seen that on the national security side in a way that was not traditional for the court. So I'll
take issue with that and invoke Chief Justice Roberts. I think Chief Justice Roberts hit the nail with his head in the Boumediene dissent. I think Chief Justice Roberts is quite right about that. Chief Justice Roberts says, is this really going to change anything?
We don't want him hitting the nail with his head.
No. I think Chief Justice, I would recommend Chief Justice Roberts' dissent in Boumediene for, you know, what effect judges have. And I think the Chief Justice has a pretty realistic view that they have a very marginal effect, even in the big splashy decisions that the New York Times covers.
Your question raises a broad issue. I mean, we've had in the last 10 years two major emergencies. We had 9/11, then we had this financial crisis. And the question is, you know, there's two ways of handling it. I think the courts are out of it. I mean, the courts are not going to, you know, respond effectively to an emergency situation. The relevant question is whether Congress should pass standing laws which confer sort of emergency standby powers on the executive. Or whether that's dangerous, because then the executive might use those powers to, you know, expand its authority and squelch our liberties and so forth, in which case then you have to wait for Congress to convene and adopt appropriate legislation in response to emergency, as they did with both 9/11 and the financial crisis. So it's a very difficult a problem, is how a democracy that's set up to have a limited federal government, as you say, is supposed to respond to national emergencies. And I don't think we've worked out a very good answer to that. I don't think, in principle, there are pretty, really good answers. It's sort of, there's bad things and good things to be said about the two logical solutions, which are inherent presidential power or standby authority from Congress.
Professor Hickman?
I don't mean to sound flip on this, but this is one reason why elections matter. You know, there's a limit to what the courts can do in these circumstances, and frankly, there probably should be a limit as to what the courts can do in these circumstances. But when we elect presidents and when we elect members of Congress, there's a reason why we should be asking them questions about their view of how they of how government should work. So when these emergencies come up, we can have some faith in how they respond rather than hoping that the courts will ride in to save the day. It's not a perfect answer by any stretch of the imagination, but it is something that I think, having just gone through an election, you know, is somewhat lacking in our electoral process. There's not a lot of discussion, frankly, in presidential or congressional elections about how the modern administrative state functions. You've seen a lot more recently about executive power because of 9/11 and now because of the bailout. You know, but that was an issue in this election, but I'm not sure exactly how well it was really discussed and fleshed out to get a good sense of what the presidential candidates, and certainly not what congressional candidates' views are, regarding how that balance of power should work.
That is a perfect note, I think, on which to end this panel. I've extremely illuminating. Let's thank our panel.
And thank our moderator. Thank you, moderator.